Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom on 2/22/2011. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and I am the host of this show. My guest is Dave Style, new president of Healthcare for All PA. Chuck Finocchio formerly held this position, so we want to take this moment to thank you, Chuck, for your many years of service. Dave Style served in the PA House from the 31st District for 16 years, from 1992 until he retired in 2008. He is currently the owner and president of Micro Trap Corporation, and which is a small Pennsylvania manufacturing company. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Dave Style.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Dave. How are you tonight?
I am well. Thank you.
Great. I want to congratulate you for your new position. We're also happy to have you aboard.
Well, I'm happy to do it because it's a cause that I do believe in very much. And so I'm very happy to do what I can to promote it and using my background and experience to hopefully really move this issue.
Yes. One thing I did not mention in the introduction, and there's no sense in pretending, but that you are a Republican, and that is such a fresh, wonderful thing that you bring to the table, because so many people in this country and in this state believe that single payer is really a partisan Democratic platform.
Well, that's one of the unfortunate things that we have to face on this, and the issue really is, what is the best way to offer health care? What is the least costly way of offering health care? What is the most effective way of offering health care? And especially, how are we going to ensure that all people are covered with health insurance? And so I come to this not as a Republican or a Democrat or anything else, but answering those questions. And that's why we have to look behind the partisan issue. Some people will equate this with big government, centrally administered systems, and therefore it's automatically bad. Well, if it costs less and serves more people, I don't know that that's bad. So that's how I come to it.
Well, that sounds good to me. I was going to ask you, how did you come? Have you always been a believer in single payer? Is this what was your moment of aha, that this was the way to go?
Actually, that's a great question, because it wasn't something that I focused on early in my legislative career. I had other issues, especially in the area of taxation and land use, that I was much more involved in. but in the last two terms, it really evolved out of my business experience, and particularly running my own company, which I was doing while I was in the legislature also. So I still had the business at that time, and I belonged to the local Chamber of Commerce. And at the chamber, and experiencing the business on a day-to-day basis, we had a lot of conversations about healthcare and the dilemmas faced particularly by small businesses, and the costs of healthcare, and the difficulty of administering healthcare programs and for small businesses. And it really came to me first that business should not be the provider of healthcare. We're just, especially when it comes to small business, it was very apparent that if we're going to have a healthcare system that depends upon business to be the primary provider of healthcare, then that is a system that is not sustainable, because it was happening in our own local business community. Many small businesses were just beginning to drop healthcare coverage or severely restricting it. So that was the first area. And then from my legislative experience, we have district offices, and we had the district office was there to serve constituent needs. And while I was involved in business and in working for major companies for many years at senior management levels, I never really thought about it, never really had to be exposed to the very real human needs that are prevalent even in affluent areas like mine. And we tried to help people with it through our district office, many of which had to do with healthcare. And it was frustrating because we couldn't really offer them a lot of choices. Good people, hardworking people, didn't have health care, contracted a major illness, cancer, heart disease, whatever, and had no health care. And we just didn't have any answers for them. And I thought, you know, this is not right. And in this country, we need to be able to provide for these people. And so those two things came together, and within the last 4 years of my legislative experience that I finally realized that we've got to come up with a different way of doing it.
Yeah, it would seem that you, as a legislature, would have seen many people coming to you with their own personal stories, and that would definitely be something that would sink in a very dramatic way, I would think.
Yeah, it does. It's just heartbreaking to have folks call you on the phone, and my district office staff faced it, you know, very, very frequently, sometimes almost every day, of parents, single parents, even husband and wife calling about a son who was, or a daughter, a child who had contracted a severe illness. They were both working. But they were working in lower wage jobs for companies that didn't provide health care, and they had nowhere to go. Now, we did have the CHIPS program in Pennsylvania, which really helped a lot of children, but even in the earlier part of my experience, we couldn't cover all of the children. So often we could cover them, but then we had the issue of the parents themselves becoming ill and being forced to stop working because they didn't have. They couldn't get health care, and they were draining what little assets they had in order to pay for health care. And that was the difficult thing to face. I just felt we had to have a better way of doing it.
I agree. As a nurse, and I see many of my fellow health care providers facing the same sort of dilemma, which is that we want to see our patients well served, and when health insurance doesn't cover them, it really does fall on our conscience, as it were. And I see that a lot of the burnout in my profession is directly related to that very issue. Our health care in this country is the best, but it costs the most, it has the least access to it. And this is very difficult for us, I think, for many people. Maybe many of my colleagues don't know the reason why they're feeling the burnout that they're feeling, but I think I can pinpoint it directly to that.
Yeah, I'm sure that in your experience you can, and I'm sure that you've seen that ultimately people do get health care. I mean, that's one of the arguments often used against the central payer system, is that, well, everybody's getting health care in this country. And it is true that ultimately you can get health care. You can go to hospital emergency rooms and other places, and you will get health care. But you're getting it later than you should be getting it. You're not getting it in a preventive way. You're getting it at much greater cost than it should be. And ultimately, we're not serving the people by forcing them into those kinds of health care, because in the end, who pays for that care? Hospitals are receiving some funds from the state through the tobacco settlement funds for uncompensated care, but it never is enough. So in the end, they have to charge somebody for that uncompensated care, And where does it go? It goes back to the people who are carrying insurance and paying for their health care, because those rates have to reflect the costs of people who don't have health care. And again, it's a hidden cost, but we have to understand that it's there, and as long as it is there, it's going to increase the costs of health care.
Well, then you have half or more of all home foreclosures in this country are due to medical people's inability to pay for their insurance costs. So there is another, even though people are getting the care, they do have to, they are being billed for it, let's put it that way, and they can't pay.
Right.
And so many of the people are losing their homes because of that, which is something that people need to be reminded of too, because it's a tragedy, really.
It is. I think it's, as I said earlier, it's just heartbreaking to have to say to a mother that, I'm sorry, you've contracted breast cancer and you can't work anymore, and I understand your husband's working but doesn't have insurance. I don't have anything to offer you. I mean, in Pennsylvania, we have adult basic, but that is a long waiting list, and it's a good program, needs to be expanded. But actually, right now, that's on the verge of dropping away. So because it isn't, there's no funds for it. So it only gets worse, and it's just that's just the kind of thing that ultimately I ask people always. Okay, if you don't like central payer system and you don't think government should be involved in healthcare, then who is responsible for healthcare?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get any answers to that. The responsibility for healthcare has to be determined. And I think we have to say to ourselves, why does government exist? If government exists, as I believe, government exists to provide those services we cannot provide for ourselves, then certainly healthcare is a service we cannot provide for ourselves. Why is it any different than education? Education is something government insures and provides for because we cannot do it by ourselves. And I see that healthcare is no different than that.
Right. Well, of course, I've been watching the news lately, and the big slashes that are about to take place in education are something that need to be looked at. I mean, that is something that I hope doesn't happen.
Well, in the end, with any budgeting, budgeting is always a matter of priorities, and there's no doubt that all programs can find ways to do more with less if we have to. It's not something that we want to do. But let's just assume for the moment that if we are spending our education dollars in the best possible way, we're administering those dollars, we're getting the most dollar for it, if that's happening, then where do we go from there? I mean, we still have to provide for that education. We have to work
right.
hard to make sure it's the best education, it's the most cost-effective education, but it's still going to have to be funded. Same is true of healthcare.
Exactly. A question for you, now that, you know, as a small business owner, as you are you beginning to see that more businesses are seeing the light about single-payer?
It's a long haul. Yes, I think actually it was interesting in Lower Bucks Chamber of Commerce just last week, or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, when we had our last meeting. I was talking to a couple of people, and they said, you know, we're beginning to come around to your way of thinking. It's central payer may be the only way. And if I'm, and they're saying they're looking at their businesses and trying to decide how they're going to continue offering health care when they're seeing huge increases in the cost of premiums year after year. It's just out of their control. And they know the ultimate answer is they're going to have to find some ways to get out of the business or severely restrict it. And that's where they're headed. Now, with the federal program, the new federal program, patient protection and I always forget the exact terminology. Some call it Obamacare, but whatever it is. Actually, that makes businesses now responsible for providing health care, and I think that only makes the situation worse.
Yes, yes.
Because we have to remember that business is competing worldwide today. My business and all of our businesses, in some way or another, we have to compete worldwide. So when we're competing worldwide, We are competing with companies whose governments provide health care. Now, they may be paying a tax for that health care, but ultimately, they do not have the upfront health care costs that we have. And so, you know, it just makes one more reason why it's tougher for us to compete with them.
Exactly. That's a beautiful – it's always been an argument for – and you call it central payer.
Yes.
But for single payer.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your Chamber of Commerce there is working with maybe becoming more open to single payer, and that is something that I think historically or you know, something that's been going on for a while is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is not – it's sort of been keeping single payer from being discussed and even in some way they've been holding it up from being passed or so forth.
Yeah, I think typically businesses have not business in general, we want to concentrate on the businesses that we're in. And we don't particularly need government over our shoulder telling us how to do our operations. So we have a natural aversion to government involvement in our businesses. But when we began to step back, and it happened in our chamber, and I'm hopeful that it will happen in others too, that we began looking at the real sources of the costs that we as businesses faced, we realized a lot of that was healthcare. And so the first, and this was before the whole federal program came about, but we began looking at it and saying, well, you know what, there's no obligation for me to provide healthcare, so I'm going to severely restrict it, or maybe I'll just get out of it. I'm in the electronics business. I'm not in the healthcare business. I don't know anything about it. But the only reason we offered healthcare was because we got to compete for employees. That's the big reason. I mean, we have to compete for the best people out there. So as we began to look at it, we realized that was where the costs were, and that then single payer, government administered kind of system didn't look so bad anymore, because sooner or later we were going to face those costs. And if we could control the costs, we could lower the costs by going to some form of a single payer, then that had a great advantage.
Well, I think there's a difference, though, between going federal single payer, which probably would have to happen in the long run, but it gets watered down so badly. But if we go state by state, and we can talk about how Pennsylvania, California, and Vermont are really on the forefront of enacting single payer, it seems like it would be less watered down and more authentic single payer system than what the federal government can start up with, because the so-called Obamacare is really sadly lacking when it comes to real single payer health care.
Yeah, and it's a huge, very, very complex program. Just as a matter of comparison, the federal bill is some 2,000 pages long. The bill that we wrote in Pennsylvania here, House Bill 1660, is 27 pages long, I believe. And it's just this, yeah, it's 27 pages. And that's a huge difference. It's so much less complex. And you actually said it very, very correctly. I believe this is a matter of state sovereignty. This is a matter that, just as the education systems are primarily administered, and I'd be very happy to have the federal government out of education completely. It should be administered by the states. We should also administer health care programs ourselves. We should decide what's right for people who live in Pennsylvania, and we should put the program together here and not have the federal government looking over our shoulder telling us how to do it.
Well, that leads me to something I've been worried about. Do you think the federal government would actually tell the state, say Pennsylvania, for instance, that we, or Vermont or California, that we have no right to try to enact a single-payer plan?
Yes, as it stands right now, that is a huge concern to us. And we are working with our federal legislators to develop some form of a waiver or opt-out for states that do put together their own healthcare systems. We have to have that, because if we don't, we are going to be subject to federal regulations under the new Federal Healthcare Act, and we're going to have to comply with those regulations. And our businesses would have no incentive or would probably resist being involved in a state system if they were also compelled to provide health care under the federal plan. So we have to get some kind of a waiver or opt-out for the states in this thing, and we need that authorization from the federal Congress. And that work is going to have to go on simultaneously with building the support for the central payer, single payer system.
That sounds, I hope that can, it sounds like somebody like you, though, knowing government as you do and have had the experience that you have had, would be in a great position to be seeing these ins and outs very clearly, whereas some people who would be in your same position but not having that experience might miss something like that, is what I'm saying. So I'm very grateful that you are where you are at this time. It's great.
Well, that background is good because even in my prior legislative experience, although I was a state legislator, I was involved in a number of issues that had federal connections. And so I did travel to Washington a number of times to work with, we had an organization called the National Conference of State Legislators, which works for the federal government and is in effect the state's lobbying agent in Washington on issues such as this, where we're trying to ensure that the states have the rights to do the things that we believe the Constitution requires them to do.
Yes. Is Pennsylvania at this time working with Vermont and California, like maybe even on a person-to-person basis or even working as a group-to-group to get each to help each other get this thing passed?
The answer is yes. There is actually a nationwide single-payer coalition, and it's a relatively loose coalition, but it does communicate in a nationwide conference call once a week, and all of the states and all of the advocacy groups within the states, which consist of healthcare professionals, business professionals, legislators, social agency folks who are interested in the single-payer system, in their particular states, we do talk on the phone regularly, once a week, to update all of us on the progress of the legislation, what works, what hasn't worked, how we raise money in order to promote the cause, what kind of bills seem to get what kind of support, who are the groups that are lending their efforts to the projects. So yes, there is a nationwide coalition, and we do communicate. It's interesting, I was up in Vermont a few weeks ago to just for a vacation doing some skiing, but it was during the week that they introduced their bill. Now, they have taken a considerably different approach from the Pennsylvania side. In Pennsylvania, our bill is reasonably specific about how a single-payer system would be developed and administered in Pennsylvania. In mm-hmm. Vermont, they introduced a bill which has just a bare framework of a single-payer system, and essentially, if passed, allows a board to be formed which would then begin filling in the blanks of the legislation and determining how and when and the healthcare system would be put together, how it would be administered, how it would be paid for. So there's two different approaches there. We're quite specific. They're very much only in a framework. And, you know, that's good because we're each going to try our own approaches and we'll see what works.
Well, it also seems like they could learn from our bill.
Yes.
That we currently have can at least get ready to fill in the blanks when the time comes faster than, I mean, let's face it, there's no reason why we can't all help each other on this one, on all things, but this especially is so important.
Yeah, it is true. And we also have a lot to learn from states that already have statewide healthcare systems, Oregon, Massachusetts, Minnesota. They have different forms or different types of healthcare systems. And it's been very helpful for all of us to begin looking at those systems because we find what works, what doesn't work. In Massachusetts, as an example, there have been some areas that have worked pretty well, but they're concerned about costs and other things that have been becoming aware of now, so that these are all things that we can learn from in the final package that works. And then I suspect that just because states are different, the types of constitutions that we have are different, and the attitudes of the people may be different, the types of business and background and experiences that we have will make things different also. So we won't all be the same, but we can learn a lot from each other.
Well, how do differences in the state, now this is may show my ignorance, but I'm curious to know how differences in the state constitution would, you know, make for different single payers in state to state?
Well, the constitutions in states are different in the sense that they grant different legislative powers, and they grant, and in granting those powers, they may restrict or may not speak of certain authorities or issues. And so where the state already has the authority to do something of this type, they have a constitution that permits it. Other states may not have the authority in their constitution to run a single-payer system, and they need constitutional amendments in order to be able to have the authority to do that. So those are the kinds of things that where constitutions might be different. And maybe the plan has to be written different. For example, if you have a state where there isn't clear constitutional authority for the state to administer a single-payer system, perhaps the single-payer system has to be devised a little differently, wherein the state provides regulations but allows the administration of this system, or requires the administration of the system through private enterprise, through a private organization, maybe even a current provider of health care who is then becomes the administrator of the state system, so that it's not a state-administered system, it's really a private-administered system under a set of state regulations. So, it can be done different ways.
Now, how is it here in Pennsylvania that makes it a little bit easier?
Well, I think in Pennsylvania, it's pretty clear that the state does have the authority to do this. As you're aware, for example, under automobile insurance, we already have certain requirements. We run an automobile insurance program which requires everybody to carry insurance. Now, that is private insurance. It's paid for by the individual. But in terms of our constitution, there does not seem to be any impediment for the state to take on the obligation of a single payer healthcare system, because our constitution has no prohibitions against doing that kind of thing.
And as far as a referendum ballot, that's something that is not required here in Pennsylvania. I know that, say, California would require a referendum ballot to get single payer passed, and the problem with that is that the insurance companies and so forth can move in on the population and kind of brainwash them to their system, so that maybe they would vote against it.
That's always an issue as to whether or not there should be a referendum on a program like this, and the legislation currently is written so as not to include a referendum. In the end, we're going to have to go through the legislative process. We could find that there would be fairly stiff legislative opposition unless there was some kind of a referendum. I suppose that's possible. And if that were the case, ultimately we might have to add some kind of a referendum clause to the bill. That would be a pretty big challenge to us. I'm very hopeful that we can encourage legislators to adopt this legislation without having to go to referendum. And I think that can happen if the right constituent groups, and by the way, I think there are two major constituent groups which have to get behind this legislation, because things like this, which are complex, at least complex in the sense that it is very broad-based, two groups have to get behind this. One is the healthcare community, and the other is the business community. If those two communities get solidly behind this legislation, it will happen. Legislation happens when the public demands it, and when the prime interest groups demand it. If those groups don't get, as a starter at least, behind the legislation, it'll be very difficult to pass it.
And I would think also the municipalities would need to get behind it as well. That is something that our Mayor Rick Gray had told us early on, that business and municipality, but also, you know, the healthcare groups need to get behind it, like the California nurses have in California.
Yeah, I think the healthcare community is really critical here, because in any kind of a single payer system, the reimbursement rates for various types of healthcare are going to be set by a state agency. And many doctors may well feel, doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, that sort of thing, may well have some real hesitation in the sense of, will they be fairly compensated? Will they have a voice that will ensure that they're fairly compensated for the services that they provide? So we're going to have to work to convince the healthcare community that they can thrive under this kind of a program. And certainly we want them to be part of the program. We want them to be part of the medical advisory boards that are established under this, to be part of the healthcare the administration of healthcare. So ultimately, that's why the healthcare community is so important. And then, as we've talked about, the business community is just critical, because they are currently the providers. They're the ones who are paying for healthcare coverage. And if they truly believe that it's time to make a change and get behind it, then this can happen.
And we have an impending feasibility study here in Pennsylvania. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's the economic impact study, which is, we use the term EIS for it. The numbers that we have in the current bill, the tax rates applicable to both individuals and to businesses, are there are rates of 3% and 10% in the bill, 3% for individuals, 10% for businesses. Those rates are rates that are the best of our estimate at this point, but if we're going to sell this, we're going to have hard data to demonstrate that what we propose is less costly than what we are currently doing. If we cannot demonstrate that, if we cannot demonstrate that the healthcare system that we propose, single-payer system, is less costly, there's no way of getting this passed, because no one's going to support a program which costs more than we're doing now. There'd be no point in doing it, really, except that we might cover a lot of people who aren't covered, but other than that, it's not going to happen. So we got to be really hard-nosed in terms of cost here. We've got to demonstrate that we can provide the program, provide the healthcare coverage for less money than we're currently spending, and that's what the economic impact study is going to do. If we have to get that funded, it's going to be done by independent financial analysts who specialize in this kind of healthcare analysis, and so we're putting together the money to do that, and that's a critical thing for us.
Who's funding this feasibility study in general? I know what you just said. Would business also be funding the study?
Well, we're out pounding the pavement. We would be happy to accept help from anybody who would care to help us. And the money's coming from a whole bunch of different places, and we don't have any big sources yet. We've been collecting. Some are business, some are individuals, some are healthcare providers, some are social service providers. We're trying to go to foundations. We don't need a lot of money. Somewhere. Excuse me, between $50,000 and $100,000 will do this for us. So we're trying to raise money from whoever we can. And maybe here is a good chance for me to throw in the website that if folks were interested in making a contribution to help us with the EIS, the website is www.health, care, HELTHCARE, #4, all, ALLPA.org. Healthcare4allpa.org.
I'm putting that right now into the chat room. We do have several people here in the chat room, so let me just put that in. So how much more do we have to raise, do you think?
We probably have somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 now that we still got. We're probably just barely halfway if we're that far. So we got a ways to go, and we really need to do this year, because if we're going to move the legislation, we've got to get that EIS done, that economic impact study.
So that would be the first thing that we should be focusing on at this point.
Yes. That's critical for us, and it's critical for us to if you're going to go into the legislature, and I've been there for many years, you got to have the facts, and because legislators want to know. Especially today, they've got to know the facts about the costs, and they're not going to move forward with legislation without knowing what the costs are. And I applaud them for that. That's exactly what they should be doing.
So the feasibility study, you have read it, you've studied it, and you think it's the best one we could possibly have at this time?
Well, the feasibility study is the economic impact study hasn't actually been done yet, but the feasibility study, and I wouldn't call it a study, it's more, the pulling together the best knowledge that we have both in the state and outside the state. What's in the legislation is the way we believe the bill should be put together, the way the law should read. But there are things in the bill that we at the moment do not have the data to support.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need the economic impact study, because we might have to alter the bill somewhat if we find out that when the economic impact study comes back and it says this area is much more costly than you have anticipated and it throws your numbers askew and you probably need more revenue in order to provide that coverage if you're going to provide it in the way the bill describes. And so that's the kind of thing we have to concentrate on in order to ensure, because we got to have answers to those questions. If we can't answer the questions, we're not going anywhere.
Yes, I hope that we can move forward with that and not have it lace, just keep moving forward. Forward momentum is what we need.
That's right. I mean, we've got to keep this thing alive, and that's why getting the EIS funded is really, really important.
I have a question here from Tom. We had all the mayors of the state of Pennsylvania meet here in Lancaster at the new convention center a few years ago, not too long ago. And the mayors in all unanimously endorsed the single-payer bills, House Bill 1660 and Senate Bill 400. All of them completely supported it. What kind of clout does that have from the people up in Harrisburg?
Huge. I think municipal government and county government, particularly county and municipal governments, are key to moving legislators on this issue. Actually, we have some data where we have looked at, and I don't have it in front of me on the cities, but I do have on the counties, that the amount of cost savings to the counties is just huge. And we base that on what the counties are currently spending for health care, as opposed to what it would cost them under our proposal at a 10% tax rate. And the savings are on the order of over $2 billion a year in savings to county governments. That's huge.
Right. It
that's
is.
Just huge.
Well,
so
certainly...
we have that data. And you multiply that many times over for municipal governments. The other thing it does, just as it does with businesses, and this is why it's so important, is that the number of people and the costs just to administer health care in municipal governments, in county governments, just as it is in businesses, is very expensive. There are in businesses, one or two people, maybe three or four in larger companies who do nothing but administer the health care program. Same thing in municipal and county governments. There are people whose time is devoted almost exclusively to administering health care. Well, they can, if they can leave those costs to someone else, a central payer, a single payer, a state agency, and they don't have to worry about that anymore, that leaves those people free to do other things that the county government is currently not able to do, to provide for other services or to replace folks who may be retiring or whatever without having to hire make additional hires. So there's a lot of opportunity for cost savings to counties and municipalities.
And jobs, it sounds like.
And jobs, yep. No question about it.
Well, that's very exciting. And in a few weeks, I think the date is the 14th of March. It is the date when Wendell Potter is coming here to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to Franklin and Marshall. And I'm sure you will be there. And Wendell is the author of Deadly Spin, which he's called a whistleblower, but he calls himself a truth teller. Are you still there? Let's see here. You're still there, Dave? I think I lost Dave. Hang on. He'll call back. But Wendell Potter is the author of Deadly Spin, which is the book that exposes Cigna Health Insurance Company for many of the different undercover tragedies that have been imposed on common citizens to make sure that they don't get their health care coverage. So hang on just a minute here.
Somehow we got cut off. I think I'm back on now.
I think we lost you, but nothing's ever lost in spirit.
Okay. I'm here.
Thank you. I was just talking about Wendell Potter coming here to Lancaster, Pennsylvania in a few weeks, March 14th.
Right.
And that will be something where we can get a lot of people together to hear Wendell and then possibly and certainly most certainly talk about the feasibility study here in the state and maybe get some people to donate some money at that time. Wendell Potter being the author of Deadly Spin, which exposes Cigna Health Insurance Companies, and Wendell being an executive there at the time, and somehow he had his moment of eureka where he saw that what he was doing was basically bad karma.
Yeah, I haven't actually met or chatted with Wendell yet. We've been playing phone tag here for the last week because I'm going to he and I are going to chat with each other about how we can mutually help each other, and I think he's writing a column or a blog that he was looking for some more input from the organization. So I do expect to connect with him in the next few days here.
And he's going to be writing an article about what you are doing here. So that will give us and you more coverage.
Right. And that's key, really, the kind of coverage, and that's why I'm so appreciative of the time you're taking with us tonight on this issue, because It is a difficult issue for people to get their arms around. They certainly understand the need for health care, but most people, and I was in the same position just a few years ago, of, well, how do we do it? What is the best way of doing it? How can we really solve all of these cost problems, these service problems? And so this type of a program that you're doing here allows us to reach out to many, many people we would never be able to contact otherwise. So we have to do a lot of these things.
And I can get the archive of this show out on all of the social networks in the next 24 hours, and more people will listen to it. And we've had a handful, at least 5 to 6 people here in the chat room. Another question that comes from the chat room is some of us are very much into alternative integrative health care. And I personally am not one to just run to the doctor. I would much rather go to my homeopath or to my naturopath, or even to my, especially even to my chiropractor, because he's very accessible to me. How would, and I think I've heard that our bill would cover alternative methods of health care to people, but I just wanted to make sure that that is true from you.
Well, it does. However, there are some criteria, and we're not, this bill is not totally specific about that. What it does is it charges the health, the board that's established, the health care board, Pennsylvania Health Care Board, it charges them with the responsibility of drawing criteria for the administration of care. And it will require them to set the standards to ensure that the types of care that can be made available here have demonstrated, first of all, that they cause no harm, and secondly, that they have that they are of benefit. I guess that's probably the best way I can say it. There's no prohibition against naturopathic methods, but there are going to be certainly some regulations governing those types of things, especially if they are not FDA regulated. If they are outside the realm of FDA regulations, there's going to have to be some determination that the treatment is either effective or at the very least causes no harm. So that will be there. But so there have to be some kind of those kinds of oversights. Just the same that we have to ensure that if a new medication comes out from a major pharmaceutical house, that just because they promote it, it ain't going to be offered under the program unless it's got an FDA stamp of approval. So it's going to have to be those kinds of things.
Yeah, I understand that. That's just the way it has to be. I mean, I'm not 100% behind the FDA because they are notoriously opposed to many of the alternative therapies that I just mentioned. Because it's not a big money maker. It doesn't make money for the powers that be.
Yeah, I mean,
but on the other hand, those things are not that expensive, really. So,
right.
Like for instance, the Queen of England is a proponent of homeopathy. Maybe that's why she's lived as long as she has. you know, all through Europe, there's. I mean, if we're going to be studying the countries that have put forth single payer to their population, we should also see that they allow the alternative medical modalities include those things in their operations. So
yeah, I think we would agree with that does there, but there's also, of course, if there isn't some kind of a gatekeeper somewhere, there's also the opportunity for folks who want to offer and promise treatment modalities that are costly and not effective at all to slip in the door, and we've got to protect against that too.
Well, speaking of gatekeepers, once something like this is passed, we would need to have people really making sure that there isn't graft, that there isn't. So many times you hear of Medicare and especially Medicare being all of the people stealing from it and so forth. And there has to be an oversight group to make sure that would be a way of giving people jobs too. People in the medical care establishment can get jobs overseeing the bill, I would think, and how it's delivered.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, because any type of this, any type of system such as this has the potential for misuse. And so that the board itself is going to be responsible for setting up, the healthcare board will be responsible for establishing the criteria, and the healthcare agency would administer an oversight program, and that oversight program we believe should be separate from the agency itself, but it has to be in so that there's audits of medical care procedures. There are audits of billing. There are audits of the practitioners in some way or another to ensure that the treatment that was provided was the right treatment, that it was paid for in the right amount, that the treatment was necessary in the first place. So that has to be part of it. That specific language is not in this bill. That would be part of the regulations that come about after the bill is passed and would be the responsibility of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Board to initiate.
And so you have looked at the Vermont bill, it sounds like, because we were discussing that. Have you looked at the California bill?
I am not too familiar with the California bill at this point, no. I'm not really conversant in that. I know that it is more detailed than the Vermont bill, but how it compares to ours, I am not aware at this point.
That would be an interesting thing to look at. And one time we had asked Paul Wellstone, the senator from Minnesota, to send us a single-payer bill that he himself had written, and he sent it to us. I was wondering if you had ever seen it yourself.
I haven't seen that particular bill, but interestingly enough, Minnesota is my native state, so I was talking to my mother the other night, and I was asking her about Minnesota's system because I've been away for a few years, and if I understand it correctly, the Minnesota does have a healthcare system in now, and I believe that the system is primarily directed at ensuring that everyone has health care and provides health care over and above what you might, if you are uninsurable in a private health care system in one way or another, then you are eligible and will receive state-provided health care coverage. But again, I'm not particularly familiar with the Wellstone bill, if that was a particular bill. I'm not aware. I don't believe that was the bill that was actually adopted by Minnesota, although Minnesota's had health care coverage for quite some time. But I have not seen the Wellstone bill.
That's kind of a little-known fact about Minnesota, I think.
Yeah.
And I think Colorado would be another one that is poised to enact single-payer.
There are another,
right.
I don't know if they're poised to do it at the moment. They certainly are in the process of debating the legislation. I think we'll see more and more states doing that. And maybe in that sense, the federal health care program actually helped us because it started moving some people to saying, well, all right, if we're going to have to address this issue, how would we want to address that in our own state? Why? How can we do that? And so perhaps in that way it's been productive in forcing more states, or at least causing more states, to become interested in developing their own healthcare system.
Yeah, I would like to also say that when we enact single payer here in Pennsylvania, the snowball effect from the next states, the state neighboring us, the state neighboring them, it's going to take off, and everybody's going to get it eventually.
Yeah, it certainly feels good, I'll be real honest with you. Pennsylvania has not always been out front on some issues, and as a legislator, I can recall going to a lot of different town meetings and proposing ideas and new ways of doing things, and I always got sort of a kickback from folks in the audience and sometimes even from colleagues in the legislature about, who's done this before? Well, maybe we should let somebody else do it and let's see if it works there, and then we'll think about it. So we weren't always innovative and we weren't always eager to make changes to the way things work. So it's a very good thing for Pennsylvania to be out in front of this and to begin moving down the road on it. So I have to applaud the people who did a lot of work on this before I ever came along.
Yes, I am very happy about that, too. We've always made fun of Pennsylvania for being so conservative, but this is more or less a grassroots movement, and the fact that Pennsylvania has paid heed to it is very, very exciting.
It is, and, in the last session, there were some, I'm just looking at them here, about 28 or 30 legislators who actually co-sponsored the bill, which is pretty good for something that's as radical and as drastic a change from current practice as this bill is. So, and I think this time we'll get even a lot more co-sponsors on it.
So what is the next move besides the feasibility study that you are all working on?
There's actually several things going on simultaneously here. One is that we've taken another a very close look at the legislation itself, and Chuck Pinocchio, and who is the executive director of Healthcare for All PA, myself and Dr. Walter Sue sat down several weeks ago and went through the bill pretty much line by line. And I just wanted to lend my legislative background and knowledge to the legislation and in the way the bill was written, because there are some things in there that are, as a legislator, if I saw them, I would, you know, immediately have a problem with. And we want to make sure that we don't have those kinds of red flags or bullseyes in the bill. So we rewrote the bill in a number of areas to make the language clearer, to make it a little simpler, to take away some of those really target areas that would certainly be very controversial. And we're in the process of rewriting the bill now, and it will be introduced as the same number, House Bill 1660, in the next month or two. So that rewrite is going on. The second thing, of course, is the fundraising effort to do the EIS. And the third thing that is going on is actually looking at the structure of the statewide organization and trying to develop a very cohesive organization. We'll be meeting in Harrisburg on the 5th with the board and the other very active members of the Healthcare for All PA organization to make sure that we have a solid plan moving forward and to get this done. So we've got some internal things that we have to make sure we have in line too. And it's for me, who's brand new, it's a good chance to meet the folks and to be able to get all of the ideas on the table and come away from that with a solid working plan.
So this must be very personally rewarding for you to be involved in this at this time.
It is. I have to say that after leaving the legislature, one of the things that I always prided myself on while I was in the Pennsylvania House was policy areas. I've never been a great politician, perhaps, but I really liked working on policy areas. I like addressing problems which seem intractable sometimes. It just seems like there's just no way to solve them. And certainly healthcare was one of those. So being able to be involved in an effort on healthcare is just something that I feel very comfortable with, and it's intellectually stimulating to be able to do it and to be able to bring people together, find the kinds of compromises that can make it work, do the hard work, the groundwork, develop the data that demonstrates that what we say is correct. Write the bill in the way and work, lobby for its passage. Yeah, that's all very exciting.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to meeting you in a few weeks when Wendell Potter comes to Lancaster, and we can use that as another opportunity to fundraise for the feasibility study, as well as have a good time.
All right. Well, I look forward to that too. And as I say, maybe we can repeat a couple of times this. www.healthcare4allpa.org for folks who'd like to get more information on the legislation, on our efforts, and if they can help us fund the economic impact study, we'd be really appreciative.
Thank you so much, Dave, for being on the show. This has been fun, and it's been educational, and I'm glad to hear that you – it's very, very interesting to hear how you have found your higher sense of destiny through doing this work.
Well, I believe it is a higher sense of destiny. It's something that when we accomplish this, all of us will be able to look back and say, you know, that was one of the most worthwhile efforts of my life, and that's certainly the way I will feel.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
I'll talk to you in a few weeks.
Good night.
Good night. playing Music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen. Good night, everybody. Thanks for coming to the chat room and listening in.